Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Just how bad is the mortgage crisis in America? In 2006, about one in five of all mortgages written in the U.S. was subprime. And today, more than one in four subprime mortgages is in some stage of default. The economic ramifications of that are extremely serious for the financial sector, the housing sector, and for any number of other industries that could go down like dominoes if these conditions continue. And investors around the globe have good reason to fear for the money they have sunk into U.S. lenders. President Bush today signed a massive relief bill to give an unlimited line of credit to government-backed lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a move that could save an estimated 400,000 homeowners from foreclosure. But how did we get here in the first place? Could any of this have been predicted or prevented? My guest this hour can offer some clear-eyed perspective. Paul Mallow has been covering the industry for more than two decades. He currently works as executive editor of National Mortgage News. His new book, co-authored with Matthew Padilla, is called Chain of Blame: How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
How did the subprime mortgage as a financial product evolve in the first place?
Well, it started out back in the 1960s. Beneficial Finance used to be this company, consumer finance company. It would make, you know, small loans to people, $100, $200, $300, you know, to tide them over, because banks didn't want to make small loans, or at least that small, and they didn't want to lend to people with so-so credit. So Beneficial Finance had been trailblazing in this area for many, many decades, and they decided they wanted to make bigger loans, and they found it in real estate. So the business was pretty small. I mean, it was, you know, a small, profitable business with low delinquencies, and the reason it was that way is that Beneficial carefully underwrote the loans, looked at the borrower, they kept the loan in their portfolio, and they didn't make a refinancing or a second lien unless the consumer had a lot of equity in that home. You know, the modern subprime crisis is one of people buying homes with no down payment, poor credit, and Wall Street financing many of the deals through these non-bank lenders. So the market had evolved. I think back in the 1960s and 70s, subprime was probably anywhere from 2 to 5% of the business, and it peaked out at about 25% of the business in 2005. So it grew tremendously, and one of the reasons it grew, as we get into in our book, Chain of Blame, is Wall Street's presence in the business.
Yeah, you talk about these non-bank lenders and other entities. One thing that some people may be aware of is that banks no longer hang on to, or mortgage lenders no longer hang on to a lot of the loans that they write. They immediately turn around and sell them.
Right. That's what we call it. When they sell a loan, it's sold into what we call a secondary market, which just means the loan has been sold to another investor or sometimes several investors. Some banks still and lenders still hang on to their adjustable rate mortgages and keep those on their balance sheet. They like those because the rate can float up or down. But for the most part, the fixed rate loans, the subprime or even the prime loans, are sold off. I mean, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, buy the good quality, the A-paper quality mortgages, and they, you know, they're involved in putting those into bonds themselves. But those are, you know, loans made to people with good credit.
Let's talk about this term predatory lending, because a lot of people instantly go to the mortgage brokers as the ones who are culpable in all this. But you have a sort of a different definition of what predatory lending really is.
Well, in my book, predatory lending is when you knowingly make a loan to someone and you know they probably can't pay it back, or, you know, they're going to probably default on it, you know, anywhere from, you know, 12 to 24 months down the road. But you rationalize that decision by saying to yourself, well, they'll refinance out of it, or they'll sell the house, they'll be okay. Meanwhile, the retail loan company or the loan broker may be charging a ton of fees, points, upfront points, charging for credit life insurance policies, charge them all sorts of fees. I mean, in our book, we note that, you know, some lenders wouldn't do a deal, subprime deal, unless they were making, you know, anywhere from $5,000 to $12,000 on the deal. I mean, that's an extreme case. There's a lot of honest brokers out there, too, and I don't want to besmirch their reputations. But, you know, there are a lot of people out there looking to make fee income. It's not just the brokers. It goes entirely up the food chain in the entire mortgage process. We got away from the old Bailey building and loan model when the savings and loan industry got clobbered in the late 1980s. we went to a model where the loan was held by the institution to one where Wall Street became, the person at the top, the entity at the top, with all sorts of players in between. So that's how the industry evolved, and now we might be going back to the old model where, lenders have some skin in the game and might keep more of their loans.
Well, do you think it will stay that way? Because there had been a little bit of a surge of subprime lending before the S&L crisis, right? And then it got knocked back down.
No, the surge was in the late 1990s. The S&L industry was back by then. We get into the history a bit in our book, and we mention Wall Street started getting involved in securitizing finance and these non-banks and took many of these companies public in the late 1990s. And then the Russian debt crisis hit and long-term capital blew up. And that was sort of the first subprime crisis. But that was a crisis not of defaults. That was one of accounting abuses and Wall Street actually running away from the industry, which caused that problem. Back then, lenders, subprime lenders were still pretty careful. And a lot of the loans didn't go into default back then because they were still requiring down payments, equity in the homes, and they were carefully underwriting the loans. Wall Street was involved in that mess to some degree as well, but not like in a different way. The new crisis is a different ballgame than that one. Also, back then we had a lot of loan brokers refinancing their customers constantly, and that screwed up a lot of companies as well.
Paul Mallow is my guest. He is executive editor of National Mortgage News and the author of Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. Let's talk for a minute, Paul, about the assumptions that the street was making about conditions in the housing market.
Okay. Well, one thing they believed, and at least they hoped, that home prices would keep going up 20% a year in a lot of these hot markets. So if a loan went bad, the consumer could just sell the house and get out, and the Wall Street firm would be okay. So that was something a lot of companies hung on to, and that's a lot of we hear that in the rationalization of what went wrong. Now, we thought prices would never keep going up, and historically, home prices as a national average never went down. At least they hadn't gone down since the Great Depression. We've had recessions, even during the S&L crisis. Some markets got hammered, like Texas and New England, and prices went down in selected markets. But on a national average, home prices never ever went down. And that was something the market, pinned its hopes on, that home prices would never go down. And if they did go down, it would be ever so small. Now we have cases where, in California, where, home prices have gone down 10, 20, 30, 40% in some neighborhoods, even more. I mean, Florida, the condo market's been hammered. So this is a whole different animal.
Is it reasonable to assume that the surge in subprime buying actually helped inflate the bubble in many of those markets?
Well, yes. I mean, more credit became available. When Wall Street got into the business, Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns, the two companies that we highlight in our book, they provided liquidity to these non-banks, meaning they lent money to the non-banks who in turn, originated these loans and sold them to Wall Street. Wall Street packaged them into bonds. So many lenders got into the business because, the short-term rates were very low, 1% or 2%. Was the short-term rate charged by the Fed, and they could lend it out at 6, 7, 8% to consumers. So there was a huge, huge profit margin. So many lenders saw this, this huge profitability from 2002 to 2005, that so many companies got into the business. It looked like a win-win. And the other thing is they created some products that, fed the ability of consumers to buy homes. And one of those was something called a stated income loan, where you basically state your income and the lender believes you as long as you have a good a FICO score, a credit score. But the loan that really did it, the one that we get into in our book, is something called the payment option arm. And that's a loan where you get four different payment options each month and you get to choose it. And one of it is you pay the loan like a normal 30-year mortgage, and you have two other options, one's like a 15-year. But the dangerous option is one called negative amortization, and that's where the consumer can keep his or her monthly payment low and add on to the debt they owe. And by keeping the payment low, they have the ability, in our opinion, in our book we get into it, to bid up the price of housing. When you give a consumer this tool, this weapon, you arm a lot of consumers with the ability to buy a house. And when you have more consumers getting into the market, it drives up the cost of housing. But even more dangerous here, we had a lot of people buying, investing in homes as speculators. And they were using these loans as well. So we had so much of this gasoline thrown on the housing market by arming people, by giving them the ability to buy homes. And that, in my opinion, helped drive up the cost of housing in some very hot markets like California, Florida, and Nevada is another one.
You talked about stated income loans, and earlier you referred to the underwriting having been very careful in the past. What sorts of due diligence was being performed during the time that subprime loans really became the thing?
Well, before, you know, in the old days, you know, they would ask for, your annual tax statements. They'd ask for paychecks. Those are the big ones, you know, payment stubs. Give me 3, 6, 9, 12 months of payment stubs. They'd ask for your W-2. I mean, you know, we manually underwriting the files. You know, you'd had paper, and someone at a mortgage company like Countrywide, for example, would, you know, look at the paper. They'd call your employer. They'd check, make sure everything checks out. I mean, that's how it used to be done, and back then, we had no problems when we did it that way. But when you get into a process where you state your income and all you do is you type in someone's Social Security number and you check their FICO score and it looks okay and you approve the loan, the guy's got no down payment, well, you know you're asking for trouble here. And also the business got computerized. I mean, you know, they ran your name and Social Security number through a database, it checked out, boom, you know, loan approved. I mean, we had companies like AmeriQuest and Argent, Roland Arnell's companies, which were, you know, involved in stated income and what we call limited documentation loan. And again, they relied on technology and the FICO scores and appraisals to make these loans. And, you know, and in the end, if you're not too careful, abuses start happening and we get into trouble. And that's what happened here.
Did investors who put their money into organizations and companies that bought up these loans, did they know what they were getting into? Did they have the real story about the risk factors in these loans?
No. One of the things we get into in Chain of Blame is a guy named Lou Ranieri, who invented the A paper, the good quality mortgage-backed security, helped invent it. And he made a speech here in Washington in late 2006, basically taking the Securities and Exchange Commission, the big Washington regulator, to task for not cracking down on disclosures in these subprime bond documents. He believed that there wasn't enough disclosures, that investors didn't really know much about the history of these kind of loans, that they weren't necessarily informed about, you know, the borrower's credit. And, you know, it was sort of a wake-up call to the industry. I don't know how many people were listening back then, but, you know, that's sort of, you know, he was one guy who laid it out. And, you know, the SEC, you know, didn't regulate. In our opinion, the SEC just was asleep at the wheel.
So people did start listening when Bear Stearns threw two of its biggest holdings into bankruptcy, right?
Yeah, that actually, it's almost a year ago to the day that happened. I think it was July 30th or 31st, when Bear threw those two hedge funds into bankruptcy, and then Angelo Mozilla made a speech to analysts about his earnings and saying the housing market was the worst since the Great Depression. That really, really started this ball rolling down the hill. And started this whole crisis. It was just a matter of someone lighting the fuse.
Angelo Mozilla, of course, is the now gone CEO of Countrywide. We'll talk a little bit more about him after this because you have a great portrait of him in the book and sort of the way he's operated over these past few decades. My guest is Paul Mollo. He's executive editor of National Mortgage News. His new book is called Chain of Blame: How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paul Mollow. His new book is called Chain of Blame: How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's talk a little bit about Angela Mozzillo, this really colorful figure that you've known for some time, who, among other things, at Countrywide, pioneered the use of loan brokers starting in the 80s.
Right, correct. Angelo is an interesting fellow, shall we say. I've known him a long time. Haven't talked to him since January. When Countrywide was getting sold to Bank of America, he said, I'm not talking anymore. He cooperated with our book to some degree. It told us the history of Countrywide. And he's the guy who was in the A-paper business for a long time, built it up from scratch. He started the company at his kitchen table. We go through the history in our book a bit and definitely into his personality. I mean, he always liked being number one. He avoided the subprime business for 30 of his 40 years at Countrywide and was doing quite well, was making money. And he liked housing Americans, I sincerely believe, when he said he took pride in it. I think he did. Then he saw the subprime business taking off in early 2000s, looked it over at Roland Arnell, the head of AmeriQuest Mortgage and Argent Mortgage. Roland was a former ambassador to the Netherlands. He passed away this March, by the way. But anyway, he saw how successful they were, and he wanted in. And he got in big time, and eventually Countrywide became the number one subprime lender in the nation. And it turned out to be a tragic decision for Mozzillo, who is a very tough, competitive businessman, and it more or less destroyed the company, that along with the payment option arm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Another person that fell down on the job, as far as you're concerned, is Alan Greenspan, who, of course, was Fed chairman for a long time. At one point, he said publicly to Americans, maybe a traditional 30-year mortgage is not the best you can do.
Right. He had a speech that's gotten a lot of press in post his post speech, shall we say, since he left the Fed, got a lot of attention. He was, basically saying an adjustable rate mortgage is a better deal for consumers. But in our book, we reveal that he himself had a fixed rate loan. One of our sources who met with him basically, asked him why he wanted a fixed rate loan, what he liked about it. His reply was that he liked the certainty of it. So here he was telling people that ARM was a better deal, but here he was himself that, lo and behold, he had a fixed rate loan. So that might make people scratch their heads a bit and wonder, what's going on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Richard in Plano. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Thank you for letting me call in.
Sure.
The question that I have is, I'd like someone to explain to me why it is that taxpayers should pay for the banks and the homeowners gambling, because that's what they were doing. They were gambling. They were taking a chance that they were going to make some money because they were hoping that home values were going to go up just like they had in the past. And it seems to me that their gamble lost and they should be responsible for it, period.
Do you have a response to that, Paul?
Well, he's right. They were gambling. I don't think people realize how much Wall Street was gambling here. Not only did we have them securitizing subprime bonds, they were creating instruments like the credit default swap and the ABX index, and the Securities and Exchange Commission was, letting them gamble on the value of those bonds. Why should we pick it up? Well, right now there's been $300 billion in losses suffered by different financial institutions because of their subprime bets on these crummy loans. So, those losses are there. They're not going away. The government is trying to help consumers by beefing up what we call the FHA program, the Federal Housing Administration, to help troubled home borrowers refinance some of their subprime loans. We'll see how many of those actually get the loans. But it's not fair to taxpayers who've been paying their mortgages at all to have to foot this bill. But we don't know what the cost is at this point. Right now, the cost is maybe $20, $30 billion off of the federal budget. But we don't know. Is it fair? No, it's definitely not fair. I think the government's trying to stabilize the situation, and they don't know what else to do. I think they're trying to prevent a wholesale meltdown of the U.S. financial system. And You know, it's probably a good thing. I think when you think about housing and mortgages and what a key part they are of the economy, I mean, home sales are down tremendously. People don't buy homes. They don't buy refrigerators. They don't buy furniture. All those businesses get hurt. So I think they're trying to establish a floor here in the housing market and try and, you know, at least stop the bleeding and get the patient, so to speak, out of the operating room and on the recovery table. But I don't think we're going to have a huge snapback in home prices anytime soon.
I want to talk about political influence of Angelo Mozilo and others. We have two senators now, Chris Dodd and Kent Conrad, mm-hmm. who allegedly got sweetheart deals from Countrywide simply for being what were called FOAs.
Right, friend of Angelo loans. We actually got into that in our book a bit before it became a huge story. We didn't know that they were actually got FOA loans. That was standard practice in the mortgage business, by the way. I mean, it wasn't just Countrywide. There were other lenders out there that made, you know, friends of fill in the name of the executive loans. You know, they got special treatment to some degree. I don't know the exact terms of their loans, but, you know, they got breaks on their mortgages because there were people in power. Is that a correct thing to do? Well, no, but they did it to curry favor. I mean, that's sadly that happens in a lot of American business where you know someone at the Toyota dealership, for example, and they get a break because you know so-and-so. So, you know, that is something those two senators will have to answer for eventually. I mean, Dodd's been mentioned as a VP candidate possibility for Barack Obama. So, you know, we'll see. That could sink him right there.
Well, it's my understanding that they've both said, well, we didn't ask for this and we didn't know we received that. And, you know, people say, oh, I don't buy that. It's ridiculous.
I don't buy it either. I mean, you know, anyone who's been through the mortgage process, and I'm sure many of your listeners have been, I mean, you know what the rate is. You know what the points are, and you've been shopping around, I hope. I mean, anyone who says they didn't know what it was, either they weren't doing the shopping themselves and their spouse or partner was doing it or someone was doing it for them. I mean, that's ludicrous to believe they didn't know they were getting a special deal.
So can we say the same thing about people who took on these really risky subprime mortgages and borrowed, you know, $400,000 when they were making 40 or whatever the amount is? Can we also say they weren't entirely victimized? They should have looked at their budgets and said, well, if anything changes, there's no way I can make that pay.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, that's probably one of the great untold stories here. The media likes to portray, you know, the victims as you know, poor people who were taken advantage. And there were definitely those out there. But, you know, a lot of people wanted to, you know, believe in the tooth fairy here and think they can afford these kind of loans or think they, oh, down the road they'll get a big promotion. You know, they rationalize in their brain without, you know, really thinking about the ramifications. But it just takes one little slip up, someone losing a good job or a spouse losing a job, and they find themselves in hot water. So, yeah, a lot of people wanted to believe in the dream or maybe they believed, I'm just going to live here for 2 years and I'll flip it. You know, I'll make $80,000 on this deal because, you know, it's already gone up $80,000 in the two previous years. So, yeah, a lot of people self-deluded themselves without a doubt. But also, don't keep in mind, there's another piece of the story that people don't forget. There were a lot of speculators out there, you know, using these low down payment loans, these payment option arms to gamble on the value of housing. So that helped feed the bubble as well.
Including a lot of people who don't actually live in the homes. There are a lot of people with bad mortgages right now who don't live in those homes.
Well, true, and that's one important distinction about this bill that probably hasn't got much play either. I mean, speculators don't get covered by this bailout, this FHA program. It's only people who are living in the house. And the bill also stipulates that when the homeowner sells the house, if they get one of these government loans, they have to share some of the upside with the federal government. Yeah, people who own multiple homes that have been speculating are out of luck. I mean, their ball game's over.
Now, the upper limit of the government program, as I understand it, is $650,000 mortgages. That buys a whole lot of house in this part of Texas. But to be fair, there
I think
are many,
it's 625.
Okay,
but,
there are okay. many parts of the country where that could be a sort of 3-bedroom, 2-bath, pretty standard house.
Oh yeah, no, in California, even you know parts of Maryland, Virginia, D.C., New England, yeah, that's you know that buys your basic house in decent neighborhoods. But you're right. In Texas, that's a huge, huge amount can buy, you know, big homes in many, many neighborhoods.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Paul Mollo is my guest. His book is called Chain of Blame: How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. Let's go to Dan in Garland. Hi, Dan.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
You know, I don't think I'm especially prescient or anything, but I was telling people back in January of '07. That this was going to happen. I said the this economy is going to collapse and it's going to be brought about by the subprime mortgage market. It was pretty obvious. Being in the real estate business, it got to be where I don't think there was anybody that was being turned down for a loan. I mean, you had people that were stating their income with no verification. You had no down payment. All these mortgage brokers was telling you, just come on in. They couldn't wait to loan you the money because they used to have a system, being a broker as well as an investor, that, you know, they used to call it conforming loans. And your loans had to conform that you had a certain amount of income, a certain amount of down payment and all the rest of it, and if it wasn't conforming, they couldn't sell it to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, or whatever. And then when they invented this securitization, that they said, well, we can take the subprime, that people don't need to have any of these factors of stability or credit worthiness, and we can take them, just run the interest rate up, and then bundle them up, and call them CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, and sell them off like they're some kind of gift to the economy. I also play this, the market, and half my newsletters, financial newsletters, was people touting, hey, this is the greatest thing in the world. I mean, there's no got no risk. These are backed by real estate, so these are perfectly safe. These are just collateralized debt obligations. And then,
Dan, you brought up a lot of interesting points. Let's make sure that we give Paul a chance.
Just one other final step is that, luckily, and I kind of laugh at this, we was able to sell this trash off around the world. We're just not the only one stuck with it. Luckily, we sold it off around the world in Britain. Everybody else got stuck with this stuff, so we didn't take the full brunt of it.
Well, thanks for your call. Are we, though, more vulnerable if the rest of the world is also suffering because of this?
Well, Dan made some good points there. I mean, you know, sadly, the rest of the world is suffering, and partly because of this, because, you know, German banks, you know, British banks, Japanese investors, Asian investors, even in the Middle East, they bought these what we call these CDOs, which were securities created from subprime securities. Merrill Lynch was heavily involved with that. We get into that in our book as well. But, you know, they like to emulate things we do here in America, and you know, they emulated subprime to some degree in the UK, and now we're seeing the bottom of that market, the legs get kicked out of that market, and the UK prices in Ireland as well are starting to really slip, and there's a lot of pain over in Great Britain. We don't see those stories on the evening news here, but it's starting to happen. You know, one thing we hope we do in this book, it's sort of like Liar's Poker. It's a book that anyone can read and understand. We try and capture the era, the mentality, as your listener just pointed out. I mean, it almost was an era of insanity, financial insanity, where Wall Street, you know, was feeding all these non-prime lenders, and people got so caught up in making money, and they forgot about being careful. They forgot about loan standards. They forgot about down payments, or they didn't care. They just felt that this housing boom would go on forever, and that increase in home prices would bail everyone out. So we tried to capture this error in our book as well, and I hope people get that picture that this was sort of madness.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yes, I have just a question, a comment, I guess, altogether here. Home ownership has always been one of the most sought-after things in this country, probably in the world. And there are two reasons why. Number one, it gives you some degree of respect in the community. And another is that you, especially in this last period, could take a very minimal income and hopefully make some sort of a profit that you couldn't have realized with your income any other way. And I think that was an important part of why people actually were interested in home ownership, regardless of how they got in. And I don't think that there's absolutely anything wrong with that at all when you're talking about people living hand-to-mouth. So I disagree really emphatically with the idea that I keep hearing, that this is some sort of an irresponsible move, when actually it is amounts to somebody trying to invest in something which they could possibly make some money where they had no money at all before. So,
what do you say to that, Paul?
Well, Home ownership's a good thing. He's right as far as that goes. Sure, people own their homes, they won't burn down the neighborhood. And another thing that should be pointed out here, and I think he alludes to this a little bit, people couldn't make money in the stock market anymore here. I mean, keep in mind the stock market, the tech bubble came in 2000. Returns on stocks were, you know, not all that wonderful. And people were out there speculating on real estate. I mean, there's one thing to invest in real estate, and real estate can be a good investment if it's done well. But a lot of these loans that were created by Wall Street, you know, allowed people to speculate with putting no money down. And who's really at risk there? If you have no skin in the game, and that's the phrase people like to use, nothing in on the deal, you know, you got nothing to lose. You know, people who are buying homes and renting them out or flipping them right away, if they're doing their homework, they might do okay. But if they get overextended and not being smart here, and they're just using these low down payment loans like going to the casino, well, then that sets, you know, a terrible precedent and sets everyone up for a fall. If you have so many people doing it, eventually you're going to create a bubble. And that's what happened here.
On the flip side of the idea that owning the home means that you won't go burn down the neighborhood, what's the consequence of all those neighborhoods that have been so hard hit by subprime foreclosures?
Well, in inner cities like Cleveland, Cuyahoga County, we get into the damage caused by Argent Mortgage there. You have many homes being boarded up, being foreclosed upon. It might have turned some of these inner city neighborhoods that were, you know, finally turning around and back into troubled areas because you have, you know, windows boarded up, squatters take your pick. You might have increased drug activity. So it's caused damage to some of these inner city neighborhoods that were reviving. But, you know, at the same time, with all these homes being foreclosed on, it's probably creating some buying opportunities to people who feel like they want to take a chance now and values have come down enough. I mean, that's if there's any benefit, it might be that. But I'm hard-pressed to point to any specific examples where we're seeing that. But you know, that's something I hear anecdotally that's creating, you know, buying opportunities for people who were priced out of the market. I mean, there's no question that – look at Florida. You have condo values going down 50% in some of these places. So now maybe these things are affordable. Maybe that's one of the silver linings here.
At least if you watch late night TV and you look at those the real estate tycoons that tell you to make a fortune on foreclosed homes. Mm. Paul Mallow is my guest. He is the author of a new book called Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paul Mallow. He's executive editor of the National Mortgage News, and he is the co-author of a new book called Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org. Paul, we haven't talked yet about the rating agencies, Moody's and Fitch and Standard & Poor's, but they did have a role in all this.
Yeah, they were the ones who rated these bonds that Wall Street was, creating from all these subprime loans being originated by some of their own Wall Street companies and these other non-banks out there like Ameriquest. You know, we didn't hold them to the fire too much in this book. We just had other people to get into. But, you know, the question is, you know, what did they know and when did they know it? You know, did they go easy on Wall Street? You know, it appears now, of course, they did. You know, one thing they relied on, from what we understand, is that the bonds had insurance from AAA insurance companies like MBIA, FGIC, and AMBIC. And one of the things they looked to, well, if the bond goes bad, you know, the insurance will, step in and make the investor whole. You know, there's all sorts of belief out there that, you know, the bond rating agencies might have been aware of some of the shortcomings in the underwriting, but we haven't yet got to the bottom of that. So they're culpable here to some degree, of course, but, you know, I don't think the final chapter has been written yet on their role in this.
That's maybe the next book. You did hear from an anonymous guy who said he worked for one of the rating agencies and told you that they would deliberately sort of clean up some of the prospective holdings so that investors wouldn't be alarmed.
Yeah, that was his take on it. He was an interesting fellow. He's mentioned in the book. You know, we're still looking into some of his more of his other claims, and we've heard the same stories from other people. You know, that's something that might be, shall we say, a sequel to this, but in the paperback edition.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Hugh in Richardson. Hi, Hugh.
Yes. Regarding Countrywide, it was announced two weeks ago here in Richardson that Bank of America would be buying Countrywide. About 3 months ago, it was in the local paper that Countrywide was going to split into two parts. And it occurs to me that Bank of America will be buying the more favorable part of Countrywide, and the less favorable part of Countrywide will be left to go bankrupt after the first of the year. Thus, when they liquidate the bankrupt part of Countrywide, there'll be a greater load for the taxpayers to absorb the bankruptcy. Could you comment?
Well, I've heard those rumors, and sir, I don't know where you saw that story. I'd be interested in looking at it. That's been a rumor that's been floating around out there for 6 months. From what I understand, you know, Bank of America bought the whole operation. You know, what they're going to take and sell off at a loss or just close, I don't know. They haven't yet made all their plans public. But that what you mentioned about Countrywide has been something that's probably been floating around on the blogs. I don't know if that was actually, was it in the Dallas Morning News or another newspaper?
Do you remember where you read that? Hugh, do you remember where you read that?
It was announced at a city meeting of a lot of the business people in Richardson. Were at Countrywide being a major employer in Richardson, they announced that Bank of America was buying Countrywide.
Well, yeah, they bought them on July 1. As far as that piece of the story goes, that's been a rumor floating around out there. And you're right, Countrywide is a huge employer in Plano, Texas. They have a big, I believe, servicing operation there. As far as, you know, they're being creating a bad bank and bankrupted, I have yet to hear any confirmation on that. So I would put that in the rumor file, and let's have everyone keep an eye on that development.
What happens, Paul, for the – there are still 3 out of 4 subprime mortgage holders who are paying every month and who are not in any kind of trouble. Does anything change for them?
Well, actually, I think that number is not that high. you know, Countrywide had the 33% delinquency rate on their subprime portfolio. It might – you know, I think the national subprime delinquency rate is probably – you know, well, maybe it is 30%. It's hard to say, but, yeah, some of these people are definitely paying. You know, let's just say it's 75%, okay? You know, well, if they have a contract to keep paying that note and they can make it, I hope they keep making it. If they think they're going to be in foreclosure or go into foreclosure, they can apply for assistance to have their loan restructured under the new bill that was just signed today by the president. Or, you know, there's an alliance put together called Hope Now, which is helping some of these struggling borrowers, you know, restructure their loan. But they have to live in the house. That's a key part of the stipulation for the Hope Now Alliance, as well as the new bill that's being signed today. So, you know, some of these people will hopefully, you know, a lot of these people hopefully will stay in their homes. And maybe down the road when their credit gets better, or they can refinance into a normal 30-year fixed-rate loan. So there's, you know, there's two sides to this story. There's a lot of people who've been paying, and it looks like they're going to keep paying, and that's good news. But we still have another $200 billion in loans out there at risk.
There are people who have less than A-grade credit who still are capable at this point in their lives of maintaining payments on a mortgage. Will they never get a mortgage in the future, or will they simply pay a lot more for it than they've had to in the past?
Well, that's a good question. You know, one thing we get into in chain of blame is the history of the industry. I mean, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, people with bad credit paid more for their loan because they had bad credit and they were a bigger risk, and lenders couldn't get away with it, and they made pretty good money doing it. You know, today the subprime industry has been wiped out. I mean, the subprime industry we knew from 2000 to 2007 has been decimated. I mean, 80% of those lenders are either not lending or dead. So, I mean, we track origination numbers at our newspaper, National Mortgage, and is, you know, I think $5 billion in subprime loans were originated in the first quarter of this year. In the first quarter of 2007, $80 billion. So the business has been wiped out, and that means people with bad credit or even slightly impaired credit are going to have to pay more and work harder to find a lender. And it also means, you know, the days of low down payment loans are over. I mean, that's gone. I mean, we're going to go back to the days where you had to have 5, 10, 20% for down payment. And that's a good thing because that helps people, you know, get fiscally conservative and save their money and get into that home. Because if people have nothing at risk, they will walk away. And it's good that people have a stake in their homes and have something at risk here because in the long haul, that causes for lower defaults and lower delinquencies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ron in Irving. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I just had a comment from a caller earlier who said it's a good thing that people are buying these homes, and I agree, although in our neighborhood north of Flower Mound, it's a new neighborhood, a new subdivision, and I saw a lot of people who are now in foreclosure who were getting into a lot more house than they could ever afford. And as you said, had no stake in it. Also curious, what was the builder? You know, the builders seem to have a stake in this because they got their money and walked away, and now it's the banks and the people holding these homes that are the losers, and the builders just sort of walked with their money.
Well, I'm not sure who the builders were in that subdivision. I know there's a lot of builders that have been wiped out as well. Some of these builders, you know, had relationships with the mortgage lenders and special deals and all that. But, you know, everyone suffered here, builders, good builders and bad builders alike. And some builders did make a lot of money and have since walked, and some of those guys are going to keep their money. But a lot of builders have gone bankrupt, too. And a lot of large ones they keep posting massive losses each quarter to the publicly traded companies. And, you know, we could see a huge consolidation out there among the home builders.
Is there a resurgence of demand for rental housing? Is that something that's at least improved?
Yes, to some degree. You know, that market hasn't collapsed. I mean, the housing market, the single-family housing market, has collapsed in many areas, or at least been, you know, nicked severely, shall we say. But people who are losing their homes, they got to live somewhere. So, yeah, they're going into the rental market. So that business is held up. So that's, you know, that's good news if you're someone who owns an apartment building. So that business has not collapsed, and that's been probably one of the few stable parts of the housing industry, the apartment rental business. So that's, you know, one of the good pieces of news here.
Paul Mallow is my guest. His book is called Chain of Blame. Let's speak next to Patricia in Dallas. Hey, Patricia.
Hi. Thanks for doing the show, Chris Boy. You are just awesome.
Oh, thank you.
My question is, aren't we as homeowners as much responsible for this as everybody else is? It used to be, if I'm not mistaken, that when you applied, you had to tell them how much you earned, and there was a rule of thumb about how much house you could buy. Is that still available, about the rule of thumb about what applies to what?
I think lenders, you know, would look at a salary and say, you know, your debt to income, what they call the debt to income ratio, you know, had to be 25 or 30%. That was considered, I think, conservative back in the old days. You know, and in the modern subprime era, some of these people, you know, if 50% of their salary was going to pay their mortgage, they were okay with that. So, you know, we're going back to more conservative, what we call conservative underwriting and tougher underwriting. So, I think I mentioned a little while ago, the days of easy money, no down payment mortgages, and people with bad credit getting loans, those days are over. We're going to go back to a system where it's a lot more conservative in the financing of these loans.
Let's go next to Mark in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I was wondering, I had heard that there was an effort in the legislature to regulate these secondary credit markets, but that that effort was headed off in the Senate. I was wondering if you could comment to that.
I'm not familiar with that. You know, Wall Street and the banks have lobbies here in Washington, and they're always, you know, trying to fight efforts to regulate their business any way they can, so it wouldn't surprise me, but I'm not familiar with that specific allegation now.
So setting aside, Paul, the houses that have been foreclosed upon and are sitting empty and boarded up right now, people who are in homes that have lost value, the houses still exist. Ostensibly, they're being maintained. How long does it take to catch up again to where the bubble left us when it popped?
Well, you know, one of the chapters in our book is, you know, 10 years of bad housing for America, question mark. You know, predicting a bottom to markets is always difficult. You never quite nail it. You never really know until it's over. I mean, people who are out there paying their mortgages and they like their homes and they like their neighborhoods, they should keep paying them as long as they don't want to move. I mean, who wants to walk away from their house and screw up their credit history? I mean, you know, depending on how much your value your home has lost, and like I said, if you like where you live, and you know, please try and stay there as long as it's not a financial burden. We don't know when this thing's going to bottom out. I think one of the things the government's trying to do by passing some of these bills is stabilize the market. I mean, it could hit bottom at year end. It could take another year or two. But one thing is rest assured, and I'll guarantee you this, is that we're not going to see a V-shaped recovery here in housing. Home prices aren't going to snap back at 20-30% in a year or two. You know, we're gonna have a slow climb out of this hole, but eventually we will come out of it. It's just a matter of demographics and numbers. People always want to own a home, and they always want that backyard, and they, you know, want this and they want that. So, you know, people will continue to own homes, but we're going to have to go back to we have a balance between supply and demand. And, you know, once again, homes will become a good investment, but we need to get the froth out of the market, and that's what's happening now.
Well, and it's clear that the industry is already making changes. And you said, you know, the end of the no down payment loan, the end of the bad credit loan. But I'm wondering if that's enough, or if you think ultimately there needs to be some additional regulation of this industry to prevent something like this from happening again.
Well, one of the good things about the bill that's being signed today is that I believe it creates licensing standards for loan brokers, which is a good thing, but also retail loan offers that say Bank America or your local bank, First National of Amarillo. You know, it creates standards, so there is some more regulation here, and that's a good thing. You know, this has just served as an amazing educational lesson to the entire nation. Even if things get better quickly, we're not going to see the subprime business come back. We're not going to see Wall Street and Merrill Lynch come back and get back in this business and do the crazy things they did. I mean, they've suffered huge losses. Citigroup, Merrill, each have written down their mortgage subprime investments by something like $40 or $50 billion. I mean, you know, no one is going to jump back into this business and do the crazy things. I think we've learned an incredible lesson. One thing I'd like to see is Glass-Steagall be erected, and that's the difference. That separated banks and securities firms. I like to see that law get re-erected, but I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Paul Mallow is executive editor of National Mortgage News. His new book, co-authored with Matthew Padilla, is called Chain of Blame: How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. Paul, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.